Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium. Episode 91, an interview with author Vincent O'Reilly. I'm always keen to promote any kind of celebration of Byzantium in popular culture, so today I talk to American author Vincent O'Reilly about his two Byzantine novels. These are attempts to fill in the gaps in the historical record, rather than fantasies with just a toehold in reality. The first is called Count No Man Happy, and tells the story of Constantine VI, the man who was sadly blinded by his mother Irene just before our narrative ended for this century. As you may remember, Constantine was betrothed to Rotrud, the daughter of Charlemagne, before the plan fell through. Theophanes claims that Constantine was very sad when the engagement broke off. Though he'd never met the princess, he seems to have developed an affection for her. Vince takes this idea and describes the frustrated world of young Constantine as he lives in his mother's shadow, struggling to be his own man. As he mentioned in the interview, he was inspired by the 1940s movie Laura, about a man falling in love with a woman he's not met, to shape the story. And, drawing on 1950s culture even further, the book uses a very interesting device to explore Constantine's mind and to connect the obscure world of Byzantium with our own modern times. This is done through the character of Beth, a 1950s pin-up model with an interest in history. As Vince explains in the interview, Beth is based on Betty Page, real-life pin-up model, and her story, as in Beth's, runs in brief snippets alongside the familiar stories of Aetius, Stavrakios, and Irene. Vince pronounces Stavrakios Stauracius, as it's spelt in English, and also refers to Nicephorus at one point. This is one of the five brothers, the other sons of Constantine V, who kept being put up to replace Irene as emperor and were repeatedly demoted, banished, and mutilated during the narrative. The second book is called Antonina, a Byzantine Slut, a title I quiz him about during our discussion. This is, of course, the Antonina, or Antonina, who was the wife of Belisarius. Like Justinian's wife, Theodora, Antonina came from a disreputable past of acting and prostitution. Yet Belisarius was loyal to her, to a fault. She came on campaign with him and made valuable contributions to his work, while also seemingly undermining his reputation with some of his subordinate officers. She was also accused of carrying on an affair with Theodosius, the son of a friend of Belisarius's, who the general adopted after his friend passed away. We know all of this gossip, of course, because Procopius, Belisarius's secretary, wrote about it in his secret history. Vincent wrote this book as a corrective to Procopius's slant. It offers a more sympathetic and pragmatic portrayal of Antonina as a tough woman in a tough world. During the interview, Vince makes reference to Robert Graves, who similarly filled in the historical gaps with his famous novel, Count Belisarius. Now, here's the interview. Vincent O'Reilly, welcome to the History of Byzantium.
Hello, Robin.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I will start with the obvious question. What first got you interested in Byzantium?
Dr. Felix Vondracek, back in when I was in college, so 60 years ago. You know, at that time, when we studied medieval history, it was entirely Western history. If you picked up a book on great military leaders, Belisarius would not have been there. So Dr. Vondracek, who is an expert on that part of the world, taught, of course, medieval history. And it was an eye-opener to me, because coming out of high school, I didn't know anything. Matter of fact, I have some vague recollection of a textbook back in my high school days that says the Roman Empire ended in the West in such and such a date, but continued a shadowy existence in the East for another 1,000 years. That 1,000-year shadowy existence was, you know, the highest civilization this side of China, if not higher than China.
And so his lecture series inspired you to want to find out more?
Oh, yes, and there wasn't much to find. At any given time, there were probably only about 6 books in English in Bacchus books in print. So you didn't have much to work with. And there was no fiction. That was it. And over the years, I tried to maintain an interest in Byzantium, but, you know, you could start working. I was a news librarian for many years, and it fades. You wish it wouldn't, but it does. And when my daughter had her first job, she bought my wife, Tomiko, and me tickets, airline tickets and hotels and things, to go to Constantinople.
Mm.
You know, the amazing thing is it all flowed back as if it just as strong as my feelings had been when I was in college. It was like there hadn't been that gap of all those years.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And was it that trip that then drew you to the idea of writing historical fiction yourself?
Well, I've always been interested in the characters I wrote about ever since Dr. Vondracek told us about them. Antonina and Belisarius, I always felt that Antonina has gotten a bad rap from historians. He was a very brave, resourceful, independent, streetwise woman, and Procopius slanders her because he's this prissy aristocrat who, I think he thought he should be Belisarius' right hand instead of her.
Huh. Interesting. And what about Constantine the Sixth?
Same thing. I learned about him from Dr. Vondracek, too. And these have stayed with me all these years, sitting in the back of my mind waiting to be written. What happened when I started writing a bit of fluff about Constantine the Sixth and the daughter of Charlemagne, Gertrude. And I was thinking of the movie, and I guess earlier the book, of Laura, which some of your listeners may know, in which a detective falls in love with a portrait of Laura. And in the end, it turns out she is alive, and he thought she was dead. But that idea of being in love with somebody you haven't met, that struck me as Constantine VI, with Charlemagne's daughter. And I started writing this little bit of fluff, and with this pin-up model from the 1950s. Now, she's not she is not Betty Page. She's very different. But it was Betty Page who inspired me, because she was also this very liberated woman. Did a lot of pin-up work. She's best known for fetish stuff, but the best stuff she ever did was her pin-ups with a glorious smile. And I got into this and thought, you know, I'd write this fluff about these people. But somewhere along the line, I remember, I knew it, I just had forgotten, that this is the guy whose mother had blinded him. Well, you can't write a piece of fluff about somebody whose mother blinds him. So the story got more serious. Had I started out to write a book like that, I probably would have taken a character from further back in his history. It might have been more believable to write the dream sequences that way. But I didn't write out the big character of Beth, I call her, because I liked the character.
That's really interesting. So it was more that you really liked the idea that Laura had inspired in you. It wasn't a deliberate attempt to try and ease a new reader into Byzantium by giving them a more familiar idea in the 1950s.
Specifically, no. But in a general sense, yes, that's why I wrote both stories, because there is very little fiction about Byzantium, and frankly, the historians don't seem to encourage it. They like their own; they have their own little niche. They don't like fiction writers getting in. But there was Count Belisarius by Robert Graves, and if you want really good writing, Robert Graves is a very good writer. But yeah. I think my story of Antonina is more historically accurate.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed Count No Man Happy very much. I think, you know, those of us who get really into a period like Byzantium, where you are left with very little to go on about what someone was really like or what they went through, it's really interesting to put flesh on those bones, even fictionally. And to imagine, you know, oh yeah, maybe, you know, I'd never thought of that. I'd never thought of this. And in particular, I think you drew out a lot of eroticism, a lot of sexuality in the story.
Too much. it's not just erotic. It tends to get a bit depraved.
Well,
Antonina doesn't.
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, but I thought that was very interesting because Constantine's story is about frustration. You know, he's unable to fully reach manhood in many ways. He's unable to be the emperor in his own right. And, you know...
His mother beats him like a child, emperor of Rome.
Exactly. And all this is with the backdrop, of course, of being the Christian emperor and his mother, you know, going on a campaign to get herself seen as the protector and savior of religion. Did you set out knowing that sex would play this part in the story?
No.
Always, or did it come out as you were writing?
No, as I say, it started out as a little bit of fluff, a little short story, and it got out of hand.
I think it's a very interesting angle on his story, and I think people will have to read to fully appreciate the title of the book.
Well, you know, I do, yes, and I do try to humanize people. Too often, these characters are portrayed either as saints or sinners. You take a guy like Nicephorus here. He's a traitor. He's a would-be rapist. He also is planning on retiring to a monastery and getting to heaven. It was a different age than ours. But the ability for self-deception is the same then as now.
Yeah. I mean, can you find a way to feel sympathy for Irene when it comes to, you know, blinding her own child?
It's kind of hard to. And I try to show the other side of her, too. I mean, again, she is able to, she is human. She has this one sex scene of sorts with her there, which is thrown in primarily to say, here is a human being. She's not always going around thinking religion.
Yeah.
Were I writing the story again, I would probably put some more politics in, because she does, it is, I hate to say, a cardboard figure as far as religion is concerned, but she is very much involved in that to the exclusion of other concerns, which she leaves to her first minister, so maybe it wasn't such a bad idea, because after all, Stauracius, her first minister, knows more about that sort of thing than she does.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, it's a it's kind of a bittersweet story, as people can imagine.
Both had a very sad life. Anybody who thinks it's necessarily a good life because you're rich or, well, you know, important, not necessarily so.
No. And, of course, Antonina, an equally complicated life, but we know so much more about her. So where with Constantine you had to add a huge amount from your own imagination, with Antonina you tried to stick as much as possible to the historical narrative as Procopius left it to us.
Except that we don't know much about her youth. So I had to make that up, and I, excuse me, I somewhat follow Graves in the idea of that meeting on the frontier, Belisarius and Antonina. But it could have, I could have written something different. I could have made it that Theodora threw these two together with the intent of being able to control Belisarius. So you can do anything in the fiction of her early years. But here was a woman who was prostituted by her own mother as soon as she hit puberty. So, I mean, what do you expect? Procopius and all the historians who follow him since, sort of degrade her. And I think that's terribly unfair. As I said before, she was a very streetwise, independent person. She's the one who led the, first of all, raised a small army, and then led the army that relieved Rome. And the noble generals, they are led up.
Yeah.
So, can I just, because Gibbon says about her something better than I can. I can just take a moment. I laid it aside here for this discussion.
Sure.
He says, she reigned with long and absolute power over the mind of her illustrious husband. And if Antonina disdained the merit of conjugal fidelity, she expressed a manly friendship to Belisarius, whom she accompanied with undaunted resolution in all the hardships and dangers of a military life. Gibbon's not known for saying nice things about people, but he does about her, and I think just because she was maligned. I think he was jealous of her.
Yeah.
But the things he doesn't say, for example, he says that besides her affair with Theodosius, she had other affairs, but goes into no detail. And from what we can read between the lines, if he'd known any facts, he would have put them there.
Yeah.
You know, he's just repeating gossip. He has a timeline, that's what I was going to say. He obscures the timeline of Antonina's infidelity. I mean, we're talking, I think it was at least 5 years apart between Sicily and Constantinople. And he makes it sound like they're one right on top of the other. Well, what were they doing in the meantime? Probably nothing, because if they had been, he would have told us.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so much of what historians have to do in a period like this is read between the lines.
But it doesn't excuse the historians since then who repeat.
No.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, not at all. But so you felt you were, you know, somewhat redressing the balance of Procopius's bias.
Oh, yes. I definitely intended this as a payback.
Yes.
I mean, I make out, and I do put in a footnote that this is not justified by the historical record, but I made him a eunuch.
As a little, revenge.
But I do explain that it's a pure invention on my part, that there's no evidence for it.
And so her position, you know, despite all her positive contributions and her strength, her position in his eyes is always demeaned, and is that what contributed to your choice of title?
Yes.
A Byzantine slut.
Yes, because she was a slut.
Yeah.
But so what? I always told my children when they were growing up, look, prostitutes are just people trying to get through life in the only way they know how.
Yeah.
And here she was, daughter of a charioteer who died, and, you know, a mother puts her on the stage and means prostituted her. She's living in this world of, you know, 42nd Street, Times Square, 8th Avenue. You don't expect a plastic saint to come out of this. But having said that, she loved Belisarius very deeply, and he her. And this was what impressed me, you know, 60 years ago, is that Belisarius didn't care. He loved her no matter what. When she had the infidelity there, I say in the book, it was like in the movie The Graduate, where the protagonist, I can't think of his name, describes the affair as a handshake. And I think that's the way Antonina probably thought about it. I mean, she had enough men, she wasn't getting so uptight about it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. One angle in particular, which I certainly didn't discuss much in the podcast, was the idea that Theodora may have used Antonina to be her eyes and ears and to increase her influence on events on campaign. I thought that was quite an interesting part of the book. Again, kind of making you think about a different side to relationships, which we might just take at face value.
And some historians take that as a given, that Theodora did that. And as I say, I could have made the story all about that from the beginning, but chose not to. But certainly she was Theodora's eyes in the on the ground there.
Yeah.
I mean, it was she who basically ran the trial of the Pope, not Belisarius.
Yeah.
Dirty his hands with that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. Did you find it difficult covering such a large period of time in the narrative? Because obviously we're talking about decades and decades passing.
Well, you know, I'm not a fiction writer specifically. I tended to write about periods in this that were interesting to me at the time, and then had to connect them together. I can't, in all honesty, I kind of tell my old English professors that I did not outline this before I got started.
So you kind of let it grow as you wrote it?
In both cases, actually, both books, yes.
And as you were writing, which part did you find the most enjoyable to write? Was it the stuff that you kind of created for yourself, or was it filling in the gaps?
Oh, the afterwards. that's where I justify my getting away from the historic record sometimes. I have one very intelligent friend who read the books, and he read the notes first.
Yeah. Yes, I should say both books have notes at the beginning and the end telling you who characters were and historical terms and places, which is all very helpful.
Well, this doesn't explain the text, but if you've forgotten it,
yeah. Absolutely, and most novels won't have an index, so it's very handy when you're dealing with unfamiliar names and places to have that.
Well, remember, I wasn't writing this for historians. I was writing it for laymen who heard of Byzantium, and they think of a china pattern or a perfume or something like
that. Yeah.
And so you do have to explain things. And even more in Count No Man Happy, I think, I find I talk to people, they don't even know what I'm talking about when I say the Eucharist. So I explain everything. And, you know, the readers will probably say, of course I know this. So, yeah. But not everybody does, this younger generation.
No, you're so right. I mean, and you have to.
Brought up in a time when our paradigm is religion and spirituality and such, that we were when I was young.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you can't take for granted people's knowledge of religious things. And I'm always looking for ways to get people into Byzantium because it is so unknown.
But it does mean the first three chapters of Count No Man Happy have to explain a lot of the religious background.
Yeah. Well, for readers, for listeners of the podcast who go to read these books, hopefully that will be no problem because most of this context will be familiar to them. Hopefully they'll get into the story quickly as I did. I hope people will check them out. You can find them on Amazon, and Antonina is in Kindle form.
They're both
fantastic.
Paperback either way.
Which is great. Perhaps we should also say that the books will say that they're by Paul Castanello.
Well, I pronounce it Castanellos and I spell it.
There you go.
But as I said, you know, who's going to read a book about Byzantium by somebody named Vince O'Reilly? But I should have put two L's in Castanellos.
Yes. Well, I've had tremendous struggles with pronouncing things correctly in Greek, despite the help of very kind people. So you have my sympathy with that. So we hope this is another way we can tempt people into learning more about Byzantium. Are you tempted to write any more? If you had the time, would there be another topic?
I have the time. Unfortunately, assuming I don't die, I'm not a young man. but it does take a lot of research. I was thinking of doing something on the time of Galla Placidia, but start just looking at the number of people involved, and it's a task.
Absolutely.
So I intend to continue to write some, but what it'll be, I don't yet know. I've done a few false starts. I haven't been happy with them, so we'll see.
Well, I think we wish you the best of luck. And,
I should mention, you know, that if you don't mind.
Yeah.
There are excerpts in the book, along with a lot of other stuff, on my website.
Absolutely.
Apuleius Books, which is easy to remember for your listeners because we all know the golden ass of Lucius Apuleius. So it's apuleiusbooks.com. And I have excerpts. I've also got my rantings and ravings about things and, you know, a lot of links to cultural stuff, Byzantine things, but also old music from when I was young and things like that.
Absolutely. And I will have links up at the historyofbyzantium.com, sending people there.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
So yes, just to clarify, if you're looking for the books online, you will see them for sale by the author Paul Castanellos, Vince's pseudonym. Find links to Vince's website at thehistoryofbyzantium.com. I will be back soon with our final end of the century episodes as I answer your questions and look forward to the 9th century.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.